Ernest, what's up? Look, I want to put you onto something that's been making waves in the personal finance world. If you've been relying on Mint to manage your finances, I got some news that might startle you at first. Mint is no more. But hold on, because every cloud has its silver lining, and in this case, that lining is Monarch Money. For those of us searching for a robust, user-friendly alternative, Monarch Money is stepping up to the plate. And from personal experience, it's hitting a home run. Let's get personal for a moment. Managing finances can be a maze of confusion, stress, and time consumption. Believe me, I've been there, jumping from one finance app to another, hoping to find that one platform that simplifies everything. Then came Monarch Money. Its ease of use, powerful features, and sleek design transformed my approach to managing finances. What truly sets Monarch apart for me, though, is its collaboration feature. With money being a top Discord trigger for many couples, the ability to seamlessly manage finances with my wife has been a game changer. No extra costs, just shared goals and clarity. But Monarch isn't just about managing your current finances, it's about building your future. Saving for that dream house, your wedding, or a once-in-a-lifetime vacation becomes not just a possibility, but a reality with Monarch's intuitive tools. It's no wonder the Wall Street Journal held it as the best app for savings growth. Monarch Money represents the next evolution in personal finance apps. It's an ad-free haven where your experience is the priority, constantly refined based on real user feedback. It's everything we've been asking for: intuitive, powerful, and relentlessly focused on user satisfaction. Now, for a bit more practicality, Monarch makes transitioning from Mint a breeze, ensuring you can bring all your tags and categories with you. Its intuitive design, customization options, and commitment to privacy and an ad-free experience make it stand out in the sea of competitors. Look, after trying out Monarch for myself, I understand why it's the top-rated personal finance app. And right now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/leisure. That's MONARCHMONEY.com/leisure for your extended 30-day free trial. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Ernest, what's up? Look, today I want to talk to you about something that's been on my mind, a real weight on my shoulders. You know, we all have these moments, big or small, that just stick with us. When we don't talk about these things, then they can start to affect our lives in unexpected ways. That's why having a space to express these feelings is so important. I know firsthand the benefits of therapy. It's been transformative for my friends and family. Therapy can help you learn crucial skills like setting boundaries and developing coping strategies. It's not just about dealing with major events. It's also about enhancing your day-to-day life, allowing you to become the best version of yourself. So if you've been thinking about therapy, BetterHelp can be a great option for you. It's entirely online, which makes it super convenient and adaptable to your busy schedule. You start by filling out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can even switch therapists at any time if you feel the need without any additional cost. So get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/earnyourleisure today to get 10% off your first month. Remember, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/earnyourleisure. Don't wait. Don't hesitate. Head over there now.
All right, guys. Welcome back. So we have a very special edition today.
Yeah.
Very special guests, very special topics. It's just very special all the way around. So, all right, we're going to get this started. But before we get it started, first we got to give a shout out to the DR. Did you know that we was number two in DR for business podcast?
I did not know
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Wow. We have a very strong following in DR. Some of our best guests, Lord of the Slums, my man Fernando, shout out to Caesar. And shout out to everybody in Dykeman.
Yeah.
It's like a second home for us. They show us so much love out there.
It was the first place when we stepped out the car. Somebody was like, yo, Troy, Rashad. And we were like, oh, they know us out here.
Yeah.
This is great.
Shout out to Dykeman. Shout out to the tournament specifically. Shout out to Miguel, Chris, Kenny, Mikey, D-Malo.
Yeah, Kiki, what up?
Sure.
Kiki, what up?
Kev. And shout out to Katrina Castro. She's a huge actress in DR, and she's a big fan of the podcast too. So the reason why I say that is that our guest, none other than John Henry,
yes, sir,
is You're Dominican, right?
Yes, I
100%,
am.
100%, right?
Yes, I am.
From the Heights.
From the Heights.
Yeah.
Might as well. That's pretty much Dominican Republic.
little DR, as a fact.
For those who don't know, yes.
So if you don't know John, I'll give you a brief introduction. He's the man, the myth, the legend. Forbes 30 under 30. His whole team actually made that. I just realized that.
Yep.
He sold his first company when he was 21 for $1 million. He started CoFund Harlem. He owns 17 apartments and 2 buildings in Pennsylvania.
Yep.
And he has a venture capital firm. This is something I'm really interested in. He has a venture capital firm. And he's 26? 26 years old. So that's a lot.
That's a lot.
So yes, can we get your story? Because I did some reading and it's crazy. So you started at 18, you were a doorman, right?
Yes, that is correct. Yep. So first off, just shout out to you guys, man. Thank you.
Appreciate you, bro. Appreciate you.
Of course.
Team behind the camera too. I'll never forget behind the camera.
Nah, for sure.
Because we've been wanting this to pop off for a minute, and I've been getting tagged on your guys' posts and not only just tagged, but DM.
I think we're gonna call them the earners. Like every Beyonce has beehive. We're gonna call them the earners.
I've been looking for a little thing like that too.
Yeah, shout out to my man Ken in Detroit. He was like, "Yo, Troy, y'all gotta call them the earners."
Earners.
So
right.
When the earners shout come to your earners. Page,
yep.
They come with
they
with a
come
mission.
Hard, man. And then I had a homegirl who was like, "Yo, I'm gonna put you guys in touch," and we ended up in touch. I'm glad this went down. So there's that, because I know it's not easy to build a community, and you guys stay very consistent, and it's very difficult to remain consistent, whether it's original content and or curation. Like your guys' curation has a very specific point of view. So as a fellow content creator, I don't take that for granted. So thank you guys.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, no
appreciate
doubt. That. So yeah, man, I mean, my story is what it is, that's out there, is well documented. And all that shit is true. You know, just like kid from the Heights, you know, grew up in a very poor family. We grew up below the poverty line.
Son of Dominican immigrants.
Two Dominican immigrants.
Yeah.
So both of my parents combined didn't make $30,000 a year. And there were six of, so I'm the youngest of four. So it's four kids plus two parents, six of us. You know, living just like pretty much everyone else in the Heights in New York in the 90s in a little one-bedroom apartment. And my pops put up a little fake wall, to make a bedroom.
Yeah, everybody know
room.
That curtain wall, man.
Yep. And so my sister had a full bed. My oldest brother had the top bunk. And I actually split the bottom bunk with my brother closest to me in age. So it's not even like we had a bunk bed. We split the bottom bunk.
It sounds like a ghost face run, right?
Yeah. which like, I guess these days sounds like, oh my God, you know, but it is what it is. And yeah, man, that was just a formative DNA. I think one big blessing that I had was growing up in a two-parent household, despite, you know, a lot of adverse. New York in the 90s was just very crazy. Mm-hmm. A lot of shit popping off. I had an oldest brother whom was of age when my parents moved to the States.
Okay. Mm.
So he was, you know, 13, 14, 15. So, you know, my parents, I feel like Kendrick, like good kid, Mad City.
Mm, okay.
Definitely Mad City. But my mom's, who was already like dealing with the effects of watching after my oldest siblings, like made sure that, you know, we were busy or some shit, you know, or stayed in. We could play just in the lobby, you know, when we were youngest. So that was the early DNA, man. And then, you know, we moved to Florida after 9/11. Also, one thing that I don't talk about that often, but there was an armed burglary in our home.
Okay.
It's a complete mistake, you know, but some cats like broke into our crib, and, you know, there were 8 guys that were all armed, tied us all up, except for me, because they didn't expect 2 people to be in the bottom bunk. Mm. And it was crazy kind of stuff. And just like that, coupled with 9/11, my folks were like, yeah, we're not gonna do this.
Get out of New York.
So we moved to Florida, spent some time there. My mom worked as a custodian in an affluent neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And so one of the perks that you get is that your kids can go to that school district whether or not you live in that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a very big blessing, because it was like a Trojan horse, got to go to this school, specifically high school. Where it's just a lot of affluent kids. And for the first time, we were broke alone. Like, I was the only broke kid.
Mm.
It's one thing when everyone's broke. It's another thing when, like, your friends have enormous homes and getting whips at age of 16 and all this kind of stuff. So that kind of put a chip on my shoulder in an interesting way. And I guess just to speed it up, I actually fell in love with music at that point in time. I was damn near Rasta. I had grown out my locks.
You know, choice you're making.
That's a fact.
Yeah. Oh, really? Yeah, no worries. Yeah, yeah. So I, you know, smoked a little too much weed and like was tie-dyeing my own shirts and shit. And picked up a guitar.
Wait, what were you listening to though?
Just like roots, like real roots, like Barrington Levy.
You was in like, entrenched.
Ziggy.
Yeah.
Ziggy's okay. I like Damian Moore.
Okay.
You know, Bob.
Paris Hammond.
As well, Steel Pulse, like roots.
Yeah,
I actually joined a roots reggae band. It was a whole Rastafarian family. It was a whole like just, I don't really, it was a whole thing. But I fell in love with the instrument, and then through reggae, discovered blues, and reggae, which I love. It's very static as a music. It's boom,
he's having a moment,
and it sits in the pocket. And then I discovered blues. It progresses a little more, and then I discovered jazz. And at that point I cut my hair and I was playing 8 hours a day, every day. No, it was not like a casual thing. I was very committed to the music, and I actually moved back to the city to pursue music. I won a scholarship. I came here for that. And then, you know, coming back to the city as a young adult and all the stimuli that you have and all the drive, you could really apply it towards anything. And so I got a job as a doorman, and that kind of started off my whole business journey.
Yeah. So the doorman situation, you said that a lot of residents, wealthy residents, will come in and out, and you decided that, hey, this is a chance here. And one of them changed your trajectory forever?
Forever. That's exactly right. The special thing about living in a big city is the proximity. There's a lot of power in proximity. And, like, you just, you know, being exposed to different life paths. And that can come in the form of anything. For me, it happened to come in the form of working the desk. And just seeing, I first had doorman on Wall Street, 75 Wall Street, which is a residential building. Mm-hmm. And like, I got exposed to, you know, like the most affluent people in the country. But that never felt attainable to me because it was like, oh, white money. I then later got the chance to doorman in Brooklyn. And who was there in that building? A lot of different people with a lot of different life paths. For instance, some folks that come to mind, notable people, the founders of Rap Genius.
Yeah, that's what you said. Yeah,
Genius. Yeah, yeah. Crazy, like, few white boys, like, yo, what up? You know, them, Pastor Carl Lentz, mega pastor of Hillsong.
Okay.
Mega pastor now, yeah. Like, globally known. There were directors. There was the founder of Voxy, this cool startup, Christina Ricci, this actress.
Oh, wow.
I mean, there was this guy named Ivan Green, a professional rock climber, professional dating coaches. I mean, every kind of career you can think of. Yeah, like some motherfucker got paid 30 G's per client to show losers how to pick up girls.
Losers.
and so, yeah, at some point, I you know, that kind of sustained proximity showed me that you can make a living doing exactly what you
want. So, like, as people are coming in, you're just having casual conversation and we're just passing, and then like, this guy, I like this kid.
Yeah, for sure. Just being interested, you know, like, you know, there were doormen who had been there for years who were sleeping on, you know, the power of.
Now, you know what? I'm glad we're having this conversation because it's something that a lot of times people take for granted, the power of networking. And like, speaking of Florida, I used to play basketball. So I went to IMG Academy. I don't know if you're into sports, but it's a real big sports academy in Florida. And one of my biggest regrets is that when I was there, like, literally, it was so many people that was there, like John McEnroe's son, Maria Sharapova, like all these different kids. And it's like a lot of these people came from very wealthy families, or they did extremely good things. And I was kind of like just in my vibe, just, you know, sheltered off just people that played basketball. But I wish that I would have, it was right in my fingertips, right? And it's like, a lot of times people don't fully understand, like, you were in the building and you networked. You wasn't like their peers, but that didn't stop you from actually networking, making relationships.
Yeah. And I just, you know, want to bring a little color to the word networking, because that, to me, it's got a fake connotation of like networking, like you're looking for something out of someone. And that was just never my whole, that was never my thing. Mm-hmm. I was never like, yo, I'm going to meet with this resident. Cause it was just like, I was just interested in you as a person.
Right. Mm-hmm. You become like part of their daily life. Like, I see you every day.
For sure.
Right? Like, we have communication.
How's your kid? Like, right. Just like,
you watch their kids grow. You watch them get a pet. You watch all these things happen.
And there's something special about when you connect with someone with no expectations in mind. And, like, that's what builds, to me, builds real depth and allows you to transcend beyond the networking bucket. Mm-hmm. And then you develop a real relationship. And I'm still friends, actual friends,
yeah,
with a lot of these people, man. And it's crazy because you're right. We weren't peers at that time. Some, you know, and a lot of us are peers for real. And right, it's just, they still look at me and like, damn, that's crazy. Because
come on, they seen the cut. You started from the bottom.
Open the door for me.
So, all right. So, how'd you get the cleaning business, though?
All right. So, the cleaning business, and I'll run through this quick because this is well documented, and I suspect that maybe some of the folks listening might have heard this bit of this. But yeah, man, there was one resident in particular. His name is Hugo. Shout out to Hugo. Love him like a brother. And yeah, he comes from where I come from. You know, different neighborhood, Brooklyn, but you know, just from being poor. And he was like, yo, what the fuck you doing, bro? Like, like, you know, at that time, so I was making $14 an hour and I was in a suit and in an AC. And like that in and of itself, you know, my pops was paid 40 cents a garment, you know, so like damn near sweatshop conditions. And so like that was a notable step up, and it was enough for me to, I made maybe $900 every 2 weeks. So it was enough for me to help the family out. But like, he just quickly let me know, man, you don't got to settle for being a doorman. You could have your own doorman, you know? And he saw my earnestness. So he put me up to something. And there were actually a number of residents who were trying to put me onto different hustles, but eventually you got to find the vehicle that feels right for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some lady tried to put me on to editing videos, making $500 a video. Like, if that was in my DNA, I could have done that.
Right.
But I ended up resonating with this approach. Hugo, who had a franchise of dry cleaner, he had at that time, you know, dozens of dry cleaners. And what I didn't know is that the facility is the most expensive part. And then most of the dry cleaners that you guys go to are actual, they're drop shops.
So let's talk about that, because I know you've probably told the story before, but on EYL, we like get deep into it. So these are kind of businesses that you see, you use every day, but I've never heard anybody explain the business model of how a dry cleaner makes money. So you had a successful dry cleaning business. You don't even have a business background. That's interesting as well. How do you know how to run a business, and how do you, like, how is that profitable? Because at one point you said you was making like the revenue was like $100,000 a month, right?
Yeah, yeah.
How is that possible?
Yeah, so you don't need a business background. You gotta be able to make a transaction happen. And that's really at the essence of the business, mm-hmm. of any business, is transactions and people. And so if, you know, a lot of people don't get off the ground because the weight of their expectations crushes, you know, the seed of the thing. Because you place all these expectations, yo, I need this shit to be a full-blown business.
Yeah.
No, motherfucker, you don't. Like, make a sale. You know, and so Hugo showed me that, so this is the way the dry cleaning model works, is like there's a facility, and that is the expensive part because these machines cost a lot of money. And dry cleaning uses something called PERC, which your clothes do get wet. So dry cleaning is like a false pretense, but it gets wet with a solvent, a chemical of sorts, solution called PERC. And so anyway, that stuff has to be handled in a very specific way and whatever. So the facilities are typically expensive. However, most dry cleaners that people interface with are actual what they call drop shops. So it's just a small retail facility, you know, like might be 400 or 500 square feet, where customers go, and it's typically in a residential neighborhood, and customers go and they drop off their garments. Like if I were to drop this off, this place would cost me like $9 and my pants and whatever. And then what those retail shops do is they actually outsource them to the facility.
Mm. Mm.
And then you typically pay on a per piece basis. So for me, Hugo gave me wholesale pricing without me having wholesale volume, i.e. this blazer as a regular customer would cost maybe $9 to dry clean. Hugo was doing it for me for $2. That's a great margin.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you have a facility, or are you doing?
Well, so Hugo did.
Hugo okay. was the facility.
So Hugo was like, "Yo, I can't really help you out in that much, but I can give you access to a facility."
Okay.
I was like, "Perfect. That's all I need."
Right.
So my job, that's why I was like, there was no silver spoon or anything. My job was, he was like, "All right, bet you have that. Go make something happen.
Good luck with it.
That's it. Yeah. See you later." Yeah. So then, you know, I took the same suit that I was doormanning in and made some cheap business cards and some fucking flyers. and I called the Giant Recliners. It was not that original, you know, and I just went to, I was walking around Harlem and just knocking on doors, literally, and getting to know the doorman and saying, yo, I know you're the key to the building because I'm a doorman too.
Right.
And like getting them to refer their residents to me anytime they had an issue or whatever, and I would break them off on the low. And I remember when I got my first call from a lady, you know, and I actually had gone to AT&T and paid them $200 to get a 212 cell phone number. So they thought they were calling a real shop. And I was having lunch with my parents and I stepped out. She was like, hi, yeah. I was like, yes. She was like, I'd like to place an order. I was like, all right, cool. She, you know, she gave me her address. I took the subway. I had no whip at the time. Took the subway. You know, she opened the door. And I was expecting, you know, I don't know what I was expecting, like to be grilled or something. And she didn't even know I was John Henry. She just thought I was the delivery guy. She's like, well, here you go.
So it's like an on-demand service.
Yep. She nice. Called. I went. I picked it up. I took it to the facility where Hugo was at.
Yeah.
On foot via train. He cleaned it. The next day, I went back to Bushwick where he was, grabbed it, went all the way up to Harlem, delivered it. And then when I delivered it, she gave me $17. And like, yes, I traveled 3 or 4 hours total to make $17, but those $17 changed my life because it was $17 from my own system.
Yeah.
And $1 from your own system is worth $1,000 from another man's.
That's powerful. And also, you know what I like about that story is that it's a lot of creativity in that. If you watch, you ever watch Casino?
Nah.
You gotta watch Casino, but
he's only 26.
In Casino, Sam Rothstein, who do you say the most important people in Vegas was, Troy?
The dealers?
Nope.
The people at the table.
The valet parkers.
Oh, yes, yes. They know everybody.
They know everybody. That's so true. Yes, yes. The thing I like, the average person, if I'm starting a cleaning business, I'm going door to door. Like, but think how much you went to the doorman because they know everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You was already a doorman yourself. So instead of having to knock on, you probably couldn't get in the building anyway, but instead of for trying sure. to knock on 300 doors and people was like, who are you? You cut the middleman out.
Yep.
You went straight to the person that speaks to everybody on a day-to-day basis.
Exactly.
You gave them an incentive because you're getting them some money for yep. every person that they referred. It's actually a brilliant system. See, things like that is like, who thinks about stuff like that?
Well,
like,
you know what I mean? Especially, I mean, you're in the industry, so you know.
Yeah,
you know
right. I mean? Like, and I that's can't. Your benefit. I can't take credit for having some brilliant idea. To your point, it was really just that's what I knew.
Yeah.
And so like some people hear this and want to replicate my path, but that was just what I knew. So what do you know?
Yeah, well, we got to give you credit though, right? Because right. there are 400 to 1,000 people who are doing the same job who didn't have that.
Sure.
You see what I'm saying?
Sure. So I'll take credit for having the drive.
Right.
But I can't take credit for having some kind of brilliance. It was just like, you know, the connection with the doorman ran deeper than the incentive, because at some point you stop even breaking them off. They do it because they develop
the rock with you like that. Yeah, yeah.
And like that, man, people underestimate this shit, man. Like, business is a lot more the art of connecting with people than it is the art of making numbers. Later, the numbers, you know, you'll make some money as a result of connecting with people, in my opinion.
So you scaled it to 100,000 a month?
Yeah, we grew, man. We were, and there was no way we would get to that volume just doing little individual residents. There was another resident of the build, that same building. I was planning to quit. You know, I was waiting for December 25th, you know, Christmas.
Yeah.
I was the building's favorite, so I was maybe going to make like 4 or 5 G's. And that was enough, man. I was going to quit and get on my shit. And I actually got fired because, you know, entrepreneurs don't make good employees. At that point, they were hitting me with conflict of interest. You know, they were like, yo, he's trying to convert residents to customers. You know, that wasn't true. But like, you know, when they want to give you the can, like
yeah, they'll find great. A way.
Yeah, oh, they'll definitely find a way.
Yeah.
So they found a way and they fired me in December. So I was really distraught, man. I thought that my shit was over. And then I got a call from a seed that I had been planting for a minute. It was, you know, one of this resident introduced me to the film industry.
Mm-hmm.
Wardrobe supervisor for The Wolf of Wall Street. Which did end up becoming the first movie I ever did.
You became the cleaning service for all the wardrobe for the film?
If you've ever seen The Wolf of Wall Street,
oh, we love that movie.
Every single piece of wardrobe from the principal actor, Leonardo, to the extras in the stockbroker scenes, like all that shit is money. And one thing people don't know is that production companies, they actually, for the most part, rent garments unless they are very specific pieces. And they're custom made. For the most part, they're rented. And the cool thing about when they're rented is that they have to return the garments dry cleaned. And so they, you know, at this point, the dry clean industry didn't have anyone that was willing to go and pick shit up at 3 a.m. And so when a multi-million dollar production has no choice but to go with an 18-year-old kid who dropped out of college and had no business experience, that tells you they have an actual need.
Yeah.
You know, so we met and like I didn't get the business right away. Months passed. And then he called me. He was like, yo, you're in luck because I got no other option. You know, he's like, you want to come grab this shit? And I was like, yeah. And I actually went to pick up my first load of laundry. When you're in the laundry business and you see big sacks of laundry, you don't see fucking sacks of clothes. You see giant money bags, literally. Like, I'm my God, there was like maybe 5 or 6 big ass bags. And and I didn't have a whip, man. And they were like, yo, you want us to
help
you?
That was going to be my next thing.
They were like, yo, you want us to help you carry this out? I was like, no. I got the van right around the corner. And I actually brought the sack one by one and left them around the corner.
Oh, shit.
And then when I was sure they wasn't looking, I went and I lugged them up the A train to my
You put them on the train?
I put them on the train.
Damn.
All six. Six bags. When you watch Wolf of Wall Street, all them shits were dragged through the uptown train.
Damn,
bro.
Wow. The A train's the worst.
Literally,
too, man.
Yo.
Just curiosity.
Big bags, bro.
What type of revenue comes from that type of cleaning
so
service?
So I must have
motion
made,
picture like that.
I must have made on that order something like maybe 2 G's or something like that. And then the margin works out to you net like damn near 70% or 65% because you pay on a per piece basis and all this other stuff. But the point is, here I was making $900 every 2 weeks, mm-hmm. and I just made 2 G's in an order. Now, not every order I knew at that point, not every order was going to be 2 G's, but you know, in theory, that if you can hit that, then you can hit it again. And so, like, that was a point with which, like, I kind of broke. I mean, really, the $17 order was what let me know, okay, yeah. it's the measure of your effort. But that one let me know, all right, there's some real money to be made. And then, long story short, we did a great job with that. I did not bring that one to Hugo, respectfully. I actually brought it to my father, whom I mentioned was a presser growing up, mm-hmm. and that's how he put us through. And it makes me cry sometimes when I think about it, man, because, you know, I was embarrassed about my father's profession growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the same thing that ended up, I was able to bring it. And my father's actually a master presser.
Mm.
He's not like he's a master presser, highly sought out. And he pressed these garments very beautifully. I brought him back. And then David Davenport, he gave me what's called the wrap, which is the final order of the entire movie when they clean every garment.
Mm.
And he said, yo, bring a truck. And I went upstate and I brought an SUV. And he was like, John, bring a truck. And I came back with a truck, and he opened up the fucking enormous garage door, and there was sacks of laundry, maybe 15 or 20 feet high, literally.
Wow.
Every garment in the entire production. And when I was looking at that, all I saw, again, was just giant money bags. yeah, and that order, I think we made 12 to 15,000. And that was enough for me to buy my first whip and just kind of keep the motion going. Because after that, he was like, yo, there's a new account in town. If you get them, you're going to be okay for a long time. That was Boardwalk Empire. And then after that, Law and Order, Person of Interest, White Collar, Amazing Spider-Man 2, Ninja Turtle, Spike Lee, Mike Tyson, Barclays Center.
the list goes on.
Yeah.
But let me ask you this. You sold it for $1 million. And I heard you said that you sold it because you wasn't passionate.
Yep.
But my thing is, you got a nice thing going. You're making a lot of money. If you're not passionate, why not just have somebody else run it and just do something else?
Because like, it's not really that simple. I don't believe in that. I don't believe in that. I believe that you're either running things with a tremendous energy and looking to grow, or you're slowly declining.
Hmm.
And now you can have a system in place that makes a decline very gradual, so you can cash out a lot over time. But I really think it's a myth that you can have this, you know, business kind of on, you know, you can have a little small business kind of on that you've set up and you deploy a manager. But that was not the way that my business was set up. My business was very high touch, specifically with the film industry, very high touch clientele. Yeah. It is not a hands off, like it's a John, we need you at 3. Like it's incredibly intense. And the only person who would deal with that shit is the owner. And so...
How many staff did you have at the peak?
15.
15 people?
15 people. Mm-hmm. you know, we had a creative director. I was very creative with my hiring. I had a branding guy. And what cleaners do you guys know that has a full-time branding person? And he taught me, I credit to Omesh Prasad, who's from the Bronx, Indian guy. He taught me my initial appreciation for font, typography, spacing, brand, touch points, you know, with the product. And so anyway, yeah, I sold that shit, man. I sold it because it was a headache. And frankly, the macro environment was not one that I wanted to, I didn't want to be in this business anymore because I saw a very bleak future for the business. Because that was 2014, which is when I sold it, December 3rd, 2014. That was the time when it was not clear if it would be Uber or Lyft. I don't know if you guys remember those days, but it was all about the Uber for everything. It was Uber for this, Uber for that, funding. And I was like, damn, I'm just looking at the picture. And I was already going toe to toe with these people. And I'm like, damn, I just don't see this faring well. Like, it just is clear to me that people are subsidizing their operations with ridiculous amounts of venture capital. At that point, I didn't have confidence in my ability to raise venture capital. And, you know, I was like, dude, I got some decent that I built. Someone's willing to pay for it. Let me just sell this shit.
$1 million?
And I could, that was a gross. That was not the net ticket price. Okay. But that was like, to me, the power of narrative and the power of confidence. And like, I started something in my own mind. I started this shit at the desk with my own mind. Put some brand behind it, bells and whistles, whatever the fuck you want to call it. Grew it, and a more experienced competitor and businessman whom, I mean, this guy was really one of the smartest guys I know, a Mexican guy. He was a mathematician by trade. And he saw value in it, and I sold it, man. And
At 21?
At 21, yes, wow. Sir.
So, all right, you just talked about VC. So this is going to bring us to our next segment. We're going to talk about venture capital. Let's That's what you're doing now. And this is something that I'm really interested in because we haven't really covered this in depth at all. So yeah, we're going to talk about that next. All right, so now we're going to talk about VCs. So we talked about VCs before previously. We had an ex-NFL player, shout out to Mike Brown, and he's doing equity crowdfunding. And he went to Duke. He used to work in Silicon Valley. So he's
Silicon.
Like, Silicon Valley. Yeah. And
we know.
So yeah, he told us about the whole VC process and all that. But like I said, one of the good things about Earn Your Leisure is that it's kind of turned into like a college course in sorts, where it's like, you know, a lot of these things you hear about, but nobody really knows the inner workings of it. And from his perspective, he told us from the outside in, but you actually have a VC firm.
Yes.
So this is, we're just getting the apple sauce from the apple orchard.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
So this is dope. So, all right. So we got to tell a story on this. How did you come into the venture capital world?
Okay. So after I sold my business, I at that time was very passionate about building some kind of startup community in Harlem. So I did that. And it initially started as like a little meetup that we call Co-Found Harlem. And it just kind of turned into, you know, at that point, because I sold the business, I had a lot more bandwidth and creativity and runway, and I wanted to make some shit happen. So we added a little business model behind it. It was not a great one, but it turned into an incubator of sorts. I convinced a developer to give me space for free. By the way, this is a thing. I learned a lot through Co-Found Harlem because it was a not-for-profit that focused on economic development, so improving the area. And so that got me to interface with politics.
So because people might not be familiar. Co-Found Harlem was an initiative that you started to help small businesses in Harlem get capital, right?
Yes, it was the first incubator in Harlem. And so that kind of project, I stepped up a little bit in my thinking. I got a little bit more macro because I was going from just operating a business. Now I'm helping other people operate. So I'm interfacing with politics because I discovered, oh shit, politicians care about the area getting better. But more important than politicians have power, but real estate developers have a very long-term interest in the area, I discovered. Longer term than politicians, because politics are just like looking for the quick election. These motherfuckers are here 40, 50 years. And so I pitched a developer to give me free space. And, you know, it was a very bold thing. And he was like, why would I do that? And I was like, well, because I'm going to incubate businesses, and the only thing I'm going to ask for them is that they stay in Harlem.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things you said, right? That the businesses had to put their headquarters in Harlem.
Yes,
for 4 years.
It started as four, ended up being two.
Okay.
And so anyway, so yeah, so we were able to get free space because they were like, all right, bet. Like, we want the value of our main business residences to go up. So they had some retail that was open. So all right, bet, cool, take that. So yeah, so we got the space, we got mentors, we made a little bit of buzz, we got companies applying. All of a sudden, I'm running an incubator. It's a not-for-profit incubator. I'm raising money through grants and fun, you know, and sponsors and shit like that. And I inadvertently got into running kind of an events business. We had a little bit of an event. That's when I really started dipping my toe into content and building a community type business. And then eventually, one of my biggest donors, who I didn't know, his name is David Rose. He's a very prolific angel investor. He's one of the most active in New York City. He pretty much was like, yo, I come from a big real estate family. You might not know that, but I want you to do what you did for CoFound Harlem for us and learn the investment side.
Can you describe what an angel funder is?
Yes. So an angel investor invests in startups with their own money. Mm. A VC, a venture capitalist, invests in startups with other people's money. Mm-hmm. And that's really the key distinction. And so David Rose is a prolific angel, and he wanted to recruit me and help him run a fund as a real estate technology fund. So we invested in real estate technology, not physical stuff, property management software. And I told Dave, I was like, yo, I don't really know any of this. He's like, John, we know real estate. You bring your energy. So anyway, fast forward a year, we learned, you know, we made some good investments. And like, I sourced the deals on my own. Like, I did everything on my own because they were too busy to really give me guidance. But the most important thing I learned had nothing to do with the job itself. It had to do with, like, the family had generational wealth. Mm-hmm. Like, they controlled dozens of thousands of units in New York City. I mean, truly a legacy family, man. I mean, when you go to, you know, Dizzy's Club, that's the Rose, you know, the Rose Hall. If you go to the American Museum of Natural History, that's the Rose Planetarium. Like, they're embedded in what it means to be New York. Mr. Rose, as David's father, large in part funded Martin Luther King Jr.'s original Million Man March in 1963. Hmm. I mean, we're talking about a legacy family. And so at that point, man, I really caught the bug. I was like, yo, I got to go do this for us. So I went back uptown. I met the fellas whom are now my partners at HCP. They had their own background. They come from a more academic background, and they were fortunate to be exposed to finance early. You know, I learned this shit through being an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. They learned this through, like, there are pathways and programs in place. There's one called SEO, and there's one called MLT. These are placement programs specifically for people of color to break into investment banking.
That's only in New York, or?
This is nationwide, I want to say.
Okay.
And yeah, these brothers actually all, you know, the group was bigger back then. They all met in these placement programs, mm-hmm. all working for banks, Goldman, Bank of America, shit like that. And they decided, like, yo, let's put our bread to work. So that, you know, they started doing that, and they kept hearing about me. Because that's one thing. If you are top of mind at whatever you do, you're going to get more opportunities. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, eventually they came on my radar, we met, and we started investing together. And one thing to clarify, and this is really important, because, you know, people who want to get into VC, like, they think if you don't have $1 million, you can't do it. But in reality, our first few checks were like 10 or 15K, by the way, split between like five guys. Mm. So it was like literally 2 or 3K each.
So that's what you all came to the table with, like, 3,000 a piece?
Yes.
Okay.
That's enough. Right now. Now, look, if you can't make / save enough to make 2 or 3K, you're not ready. But yeah, if you're not bullshitting and you're serious about your shit, you can stack 2K, 2 or 3K.
So five of you come up with 3,000. You got 15.
We put together 15.
And then, right? what's the vision now? Like,
and then, where are we attacking? And then it's like, all right, bet. Now, where do we put it?
Right.
You know, and so the quality of your deal flow increases over time. But at first, you know, we caught word of a local cafe that was looking for money. Cool. We put a little bit of bread into that. Got to experience what it was like to be invested in small business. We caught word of a dental practice. A guy that was buying a dental practice looking for money. Boom. you know, because you start communicating, yo, I'm looking for businesses to invest in, you do get deal flow back. Yeah. You put it out and you start getting deal flow back. We caught word of a venture company. And so we invested in a couple of different, a few different asset classes.
All with the initial 15? Nope. Or we're grossing as we go?
Nope. So it was like, we did capital calls.
Okay.
Which is like, hey, we found a deal. It's time to put bread up. So that's a capital call. And you hit the whole group.
Between all the five of you?
There was like six.
Six of you? Okay.
So there was like six.
All right. So now it's like, okay, we put the first 15, but we need to put five more in each.
Yeah. I mean, five was a lot for me at the time. But like, you know, it was like, hey, we found a deal. Who can put what was really the question.
Okay.
And like, if I was more liquid at that time and really liked the deal, I might've put four. And then we might've had a partner who was like, yo, I can only put one right now. And so it would vary. And so, yeah, over time, you know, the interesting thing, and this is credit to my partners at Harlem Capital, is like, we always treated 25K like it was 25 million. And now we've closed on 25 million.
So,
you know, so it's just crazy because you got to treat the baby step with as much respect as the end goal.
So how did you, all right, how did that work out as far as the first, the early, like look at even the first deal that you had, the dentist office or the bakery, you gave him like what, like $5,000, something like that? Or
yeah, so the way the actual mechanics, because I know EYL likes to get into that, is so the way you do it is you form an LLC.
Okay.
And so each of the partners become members in that LLC. You name that shit whatever you want. And so it ends up being what we call an SPV, which is a special purpose vehicle, which is pretty much fancy talk for saying like, hey, anytime we invest in said company, it's going to come through this entity. Mm-hmm. Right. And the LLC is a fascinating legal entity because it's a flow through entity. So it's like you become members in that and like you... On the company, let's say we invest in, you know, the cafe, on that company's docs, on the formation documents for that company, they're going to see Harlem Capital Partners LLC on there. But then, you know, if we make a profit or a loss, the profits and or losses from that entity flows through to each of the individual partners. So it's really just like a shield. Mm-hmm. It's like a step away. It's removed. So anyway, you make an LLC. You invite whomever, for anyone listening who wants to create a little syndicate, that's what you call it, an angel syndicate. You invite homies that you think are serious. You join the LLC. You brand it, come up with a cool name. And then you start communicating it to the world at large that you're looking to invest. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then you look for deal flow. And that's, you know, that's how it works. And so we would put 10K and then I think we ended up doing like six deals as angels. Hmm. 10, 15, 20 if it was a hot deal. Mm-hmm. 10 if I was low on cash. And like, man, it's not really about, we haven't seen a dollar, by the way, from any of the angel investments we've made. Mm-hmm. In fact, we've lost money.
Okay.
Yeah. The cafe closed down. You know, we've seen some distributions from the dental practice, but not really. A lot of stuff doesn't work out according to plan. But the most important thing is being on the ride.
Yeah.
Like, I don't listen to anyone in business who hasn't lost more money than me. Like, you gotta get skin in the game. I can't take you serious if you don't have skin in the game.
Yeah.
You guys got cameras, you got mics.
We lost a lot of money.
If this shit wouldn't have worked out, you got the focus right. You got the MacBook, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, you guys are putting bread in. You put bread up to buy the shirts. You're putting bread in.
That's right.
And so anyway, with the angel investing thing, it's a lot more important to get in the game. And you will not know. This is why at the beginning you asked me like, yo, have I got any book tips? And I said, I don't really fuck with books, because you will not know what asset class you like until you invest in it. I thought I loved investing in small business. And then I discovered I really don't like this shit. Because when I was meeting with the biz owners, we were talking about napkins and forks. And I'm like, dude, I want to talk about scale and, you know, like... This just wasn't for me. I discovered that I like real estate a lot. I love real estate. I wouldn't have known that unless I jumped in. So I'm a really big fan of jumping in. And if you can't jump in at a big scale, you jump in at a small scale, just jump in.
So how does that work when it's six of you, right, as far as decisions? Is it like majority, or if it's like, you know what, you don't like it, you're just not part of this deal?
Yeah, so it has changed over time. So when we were in Angel Syndicate, it was like, hey, are you interested? Some folks might have said no. But also, you know, going back to this business is really a people first thing, you know, is also respect for your partners, because your partner might find a good deal and, you know, might have gotten in a good rapport with that founder, and then 2 months in, it's time to invest. And like, you know, I want to support the fact that my partner is excited about this deal, and I'm going to put up, I'm not going to step up big. I might put up $1,000 and be like, yo, all right, cool. You know, put that in the deal. Conversely, when it's a hot deal, when it's, by the way, hot deals, you're not, they're not pitching you, you're pitching them to get in. Hot deals are oversubscribed, meaning a company typically will raise a finite amount of capital. It's what we call a round, at a fixed valuation. Okay. So they'll say, hey, I'm raising $1.5 million at an $8 million valuation, i.e., they're giving away 20% of the company. And then if it's a hot deal, you get good funds in investing. And so like a fund, you know, is like, for anyone maybe doesn't know, is like, you know, entrepreneurs who go out there and raise money from the market, you know, in institutions, endowments, shit like that. And, you know, they have a great brand name. And over time, especially from Silicon Valley, you've had prestige funds emerge. These are funds that have proven track record, that they know how to spot winners. Sequoia, Benchmark, Kleiner Perkins. Whenever you see them on the cap table is short for capitalization table, which is the page on your company's documents that shows who owns what. Mm-hmm. And so the cap table, you'll see a list and it'll say Nas invested 50K, owns 2%.
That's some Queensbridge Ventures, right?
Yeah, and so he also invests as an angel. You know, such and such invested this. So the cap table. So we have this thing in VC, you want to be on cap tables, you know? Like, a lot of motherfuckers talking shit, but I never see you on the cap table, you know? You might be at the club table, but I don't see you at the cap table.
They got the crap table.
Yeah, right. So, that's good. You're on the crap table, you ain't on the cap table. All right. So, when you see a marquee fund, meaning a top fund on the cap table, it's a competitive deal. That founder has options. And we were fortunate a couple of times to squeeze into a very competitive deal. And in those deals, when a deal is hot, you want to make sure you, as much as it costs you, I don't care if you got to pawn your fucking watch, get in the deal in as big of a way as you can. You might lose that money, I'm not going to lie. Yeah. But when you can get a good amount of exposure into that deal, you know, those deals that end up doing 10, 20X,
I'm gonna ask you a question.
Those are some good deals, bro.
Before I forget this, the reason why I like this podcast is that we get to interview people, and nobody, like the last guest that we had was talking about stocks. Shout out to Wall Street Trapper, and he was saying how it excites him, and like you, I could see like it's like you seen Paid in Full before.
Yeah.
Okay. So
yeah, I seen that. Like, come on now.
So with Mitch, he was like, I love the game. Yeah, obviously, yeah, he was talking about an illegal game, but
right,
business is like a competitive sport.
Yep.
So it's like that's what I really loved, like even with Steve Jobs when he said that it's the process that really excites him, not even actually getting there. It's just
not the journey.
And it's like, for people, I really want everybody to understand, because even like with the podcast, it's like it's ups and downs, but it's an exciting ride.
Sure.
And I could tell it, I could see the excitement when you're telling a story. And it's like, for people that have never been entrepreneurs, I just encourage just to have that feeling.
Yeah,
it's,
man.
It's like a natural high.
Yeah.
The feeling is everything, bro.
But I wanted to ask you, so how do you, all right, so you started as angel investors and you said that didn't really work out for you guys for the most part. It wasn't profitable.
Yeah, right? I mean, so one thing to know is like when you make an angel investment, the yield curve on it, is meaning the amount of time with which you're expected to make anything back, if at all, is typically 7 to 9 years, because that's the average life cycle of a business. And so when I say we haven't made any money, it's like
still a chance.
For sure. Right. And we're in some companies that we're expecting to make some money back. But like I quickly found out, like, it's funny because, you know, we're making deals, and every time we make a deal, we announce that deal. And so my social was blowing up. Yo, you're angel investor. I'm like, yeah, you know. And then I'm like, fuck, I'm not seeing any money back. Like it just literally feels like you're just like your money's just disappearing, because it goes to work. And then what happens, for anyone who doesn't know how you make money in venture, you only make money in venture on a liquidation event, which is the company is sold. You do not, contrary to small business investing, if you invest in an ice cream shop, barber shop, restaurant, whatever, you're yielding profits. So you have a profit split.
So because example would be like when Nas or in his firm invests in Ring, and then Ring gets bought by Amazon
or PillPack.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah. PillPack. So if you invest in a restaurant, you're making quarterly dividends.
Yeah.
You get cash flows. In venture, because you're typically reinvesting profits in the business, because growth and profits are inversely correlated. If you want to grow, you got to sacrifice profits. And so it's a very different kind of investing game. So you don't invest in a startup with the pretense that you're going to get profits. You would be hurting that business. Mm-hmm. So the trick is jumping in and getting in early at a nice valuation. On average, we invest in businesses. The businesses that are coming from the Midwest are on average valued between 4 to 6 million in venture, and businesses along the coast are valued between 8 to 10 million. So now 80% of M&A, which is mergers and acquisitions, are happening right now between the $150 to $200 million price point. Mm-hmm. Like Gimlet Media got acquired for $200 million by Spotify or whatever. If I would have gotten into Gimlet Media when they were worth $10 million, you do the math on that. You get in at 10, they get sold at 200, whoop, you know, you got a 20X. So what money did you put into that deal? You know, if you put in 100, that'll tell you what you net at the yeah. back end. So anyway, I'm just clarifying how you actually make money in venture. Mm-hmm. You get in at the sweet spot, and then that business grows, and if you're fortunate, it gets acquired, and then you net.
What's the difference between the valuation of cities that are inland and the ones against the coast?
That's a great question. And the real reason that businesses are priced differently based on geographies yeah. is due to cost of living.
Okay.
So like businesses you might make more as an individual in New York. And so as a result, employees are more expensive, offices are worth more. And there's also more capital in that market. And right. so you can usually justify a higher price point. Whereas I love investing in businesses from the Midwest because they're reasonably priced. In fact, they say, this is a nugget, VCs say that the actual valuation, the true valuation of a business is the Midwest valuation. And then when you go out to the coast, you get inflated. Because when you're in Silicon Valley, those motherfuckers will pay any price for any business. And so we actually rarely invest in, we haven't invested in a single business from the Valley. Because by the time they come to us, they're like, oh yeah, we're worth $20 million. I'm like, show me your revenue. They got $100K revenue. I ain't paying $20 million for $100K in revenue. So like there's one thing to know as well is like there's actual different investment climates among the coasts. The West Coast is very like, yo, we're looking to scale by any means. And the East Coast is a little bit more like conservative. We're looking for revenue and a little bit more modest growth. But revenue.
How did you go from being angels to having like a VC?
That's the question, right? So, and we get this a lot because people will say, yo, I want to break into VC.
Yeah.
Well, there's a number of ways. You either work at a venture firm. Good luck breaking into one. They're very exclusive. Or like the path that we took, we started as angels. And eventually, once you have enough of a track record, you can go out to the market as a whole and say, hey, here's my thesis. Like, here's my idea. And it could be like our shit is around investing in diverse founders. Like, we invest in women and minorities. But that doesn't have to be your thesis. Your thesis could be around sports. Your thesis could be around music. Yo, I want to create a fund that invests in, you know, music companies, sports companies, sewage, you name it. And the true test of whether you can raise a fund or not is if you can convince enough people to believe in your shit. And what I found out raising money is there's a lot of motherfuckers with money out there.
Bro. That's a fact.
You said that the goal is to invest in 1,000 companies over the next 20 years, right?
Yes, sir.
So that would mean like 50 companies. Is that the goal? Like you're doing 50 companies?
We're doing 1,000 founders over 20 years.
Okay.
So like if we invest in one company that has 4 founders, we're counting that as 4.
Okay.
But yeah, the way our fund model is structured right now, we're looking at doing 30 deals out of this first fund. And then, you know, it'll accelerate. So it's not very linear. It's like our first fund might be 25 to 40 million. Our second fund is going to be 100 million. Then quarter billion, and then a billion. We're thinking pretty big. So
it's all relationships. You build relationships with people, and they invest in your fund.
Yep, that's right. The same way that entrepreneurs are asking for money, we're doing the same shit.
Okay.
And so the biggest misconception, like when we close our fund and we make the announcement, I think it's going to make a very big splash because we're going to be like, you know, young, of color, and we, I think we're going to raise a considerable amount. People are going to look at the headline and automatically think that we're...
It's you.
It's not our bread.
Okay.
That's full disclosure. Not our bread.
Well, that's important to know.
It's very important to know.
Because a lot of times people, the angel and the VC, they kind of get that mix. And they think if you have a VC firm, all of that money is your money that you're putting up.
Yeah. And if you want... So I'll just break this down quickly. The fund model, all right? This is how you make money. When you cross over from angel to VC, you get paid on what's called the 2 and 20. That's the fee structure. So the 2 refers to your management fee. So whatever the total size of your fund is, this is why you're incentivized to go for a big fund. Whatever the total size of that fund is, 2% of that annually is what you make as your fee. So on a $25 million fund, 2% of that is 500 grand. So you get 500 grand every year to pay for salary, office, travel, everything. Now, if, you know, with a team of 4, an office and stuff like that, like, you know, you might make 100 G's on salary. Like, that's nice, but you're not going to get rich off of that. Yeah. You're not meant to get rich off of that. Mm-hmm. The LP, there's two kinds of partners in a fund. There's the GP, the general partner, which is the partner that's putting in the work. And then there's the LPs, the limited partners, the person who's investing. So your LPs do not want you to get rich off the fees, because then you would never work. You get rich on the other side. I remember I said it's 2 and 20. 2 is the management fee. The 20 is what we call the carry. And the carry is your share of the profits. So now, because we can get in a little detail, I'll just explain this. Typically, you as the GP, if you set out to go raise a fund, your commitment to the fund, you put up 1% of the total fund. Okay? So if my partners and I are set out to raise, as an example, 20 million, 1% of that is 200,000. So we have to come up with 200 G's across, you know, the 4 of us. Okay, bet. Now, but here's a mind-blowing shit. Remember, I said the 20 is, that refers to your share of the profits, which is 20%. So we're making 20% of the profits on 20 million. So it's just like, you know, I guess it might be complicated. It's like ingrained in me now, so it's not that complicated to me now. But like, in a nutshell, if you can put together 200 G's, it's buying you a ticket to get the profits on 20 million. Like,
so that's 2 million, right?
Well, it depends on how much money you make with the 20 million. Okay, yeah. And that's the incentive.
Okay.
So it's like, can you make this 20 million and turn it into 100 million? Mm-hmm. If you do, you get 20% of that. Okay. You get 20 million.
20 million.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, it gets complicated, but like,
how can people, if they want to, we're going to move on to the next segment, but I want to, so if people are interested in like pitching their business, is it like Shark Tank? How realistic is Shark Tank?
Shark Tank is to angel investing what Indiana Jones is to archaeology. Yeah.
So they're not coming in front of you and you're not. Nah. So how do they pitch?
No disrespect to Indiana Jones.
Shout out to Indiana Jones, man. That was a legend.
Harrison Ford's a legend.
Nothing like that shit.
Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
So yeah, how do they pitch?
The real way is like, people send in a pitch deck. And we, you know, and then, you know, if the pitch deck looks good, then we'll assign a part. There's different levels of a deal screen. So, you know, pitch deck looks good. If not, then we pass pretty quick. And we see 1,000 deals a year. We invest in 10 deals a year. So we're talking about a 1% investment rate. So if we see a hot deal, one partner is jumping on the phone with that founder. Then that partner reports back with about a page of notes to the rest of the team. Yo, cool. And then if there's interest, then another partner will jump in. As many partners as are interested, then we jump in with the full team. We try and get a fuller team situation, and we learn more. We have interns. So then our interns might go and do market research and analyze what we can expect to make. And then interest grows. And usually you have every partner leads their own deal at the fund. So it's all about like, yo, all right, what deals am I getting? Mm-hmm. Versus Brandon, versus Jerry, versus Henri. We're all looking for our own deals. And to your question about voting, we have a conviction over consensus philosophy. Like, it's not like all of us have to agree. It's like, is someone really worked up about this deal, and can you get people excited?
Yeah. You're judging off the passion of one of your partners
for
or yourself.
Sure.
Okay.
And their ability to defend the deal, and we'll test, we'll heat check each other and grill each other. Like, yo, I don't know if this deal's gonna make it. Like I tried to get a media deal through and I couldn't get it through. It got shut down because my partners were like, yo, you know, the media climate is really hairy right now. You know, Vice and BuzzFeed and Refinery 29, you know, they're not doing too well and they're the big dogs. So how the small dogs, and you just, it's a mental game. And if you can get people excited, then we close the deal and we say, all right, bet, we're going to invest X amount. And then we just wire them the money. And then we put prayers up. You know?
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. 101, 103, 104, and 105.
Right.
That was it right there.
Venture capital and angel investment. We're going to our last segment. All right. So in the last segment, we're going to talk about something that's near and dear to our heart.
Absolutely.
Is media, right?
Yes, sir.
So I heard you talk previously, and you have interesting views about media. And you still have your own podcast?
Yeah, I have I've done a number of podcasts. Yeah.
Okay. And then you have the show on Vice.
Yes, I do.
Hustle.
Yeah.
So, all right. So, how does that work as far as being on the other side of the coin, as far as like, because Vice is a huge operation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's the inner workings of that? Like having your own show.
Yeah. How did that even come about?
Yeah. So the essence of media is communicating who you are, what you do, and why you do it in a way that resonates with an end consumer, with another person pretty much on the other side of that screen. And like, that's just a very unique opportunity that we have specific to this generation. Mm-hmm. And like, at the essence of having a show and all this other stuff, like, and even Earn Your Leisure, like at the essence of it is like, people are picking out what you're putting down. Like, they fuck with what you're saying and what your guests say and all this other stuff. And that's really the most important part, man. And once you're able to, over time, if you stay consistent, if you look at my earliest videos, man, really bad, you know, cheesy, stiff. And like, you know, some, I have people that reach out to me that are trying to get into video now, but they're comparing their day one shit to like my stuff now. And it's like, it's not going to be the same. But if you're willing to deal with the discomfort of being new at this for enough period of time, and you get through some of the kinks and you learn to express yourself on this specific medium, whatever that is, it could be writing, like my boy Julian Mitchell writes for Forbes and Beats. It could be podcasting. It could be video. Whichever the medium, once you have gone through the reps and get good at expressing yourself in that medium, then what happens is you start building a community, an audience of people who fuck with you, you know? And then once you have that, which is like messenger, message, and audience, and that virtuous cycle opens up the door for a lot. And so the first big media project that I was invited to do was a podcast that I hosted for eBay that was produced by a company called Gimlet Media. And that, like, that project, like, I got paid like 50 G's to do that. And like, I didn't even know that you could get paid to do some shit that I would do for free.
If you do something good, get paid for it.
eBay was like, yo, we have millions of sellers. And Gimlet's like, yo, we have millions of listeners. And you know, they'd cut a deal between themselves. eBay was looking to produce a podcast. Gimlet, that's their business, producing podcasts. Boom, that's a branded podcast, meaning it's brought to you by eBay.
Yeah.
And then what happens is they look for hosts. And so, you know, because I was already out there doing my thing, my name came up in the conversation. And that's why I really believe if you're not out there doing your thing with a fucking phone, then you're never going to get to a bigger screen.
Mm.
So start with whatever screen you got.
Yeah.
And so I was fortunate to come with conversation. I met with the lady. She really liked me. I got the opportunity to host my first bigger scale branded production. And Gimlet is very special the way they do their podcast. Like, we had four producers, we had a creative director. It was like a big production. I was traveling.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Yeah, so it wasn't like a regular thing, but that was my first like thing. Okay, boom, we did two seasons of that, and then, you know, my speaking started taking off because it's all a virtuous cycle. It all feeds each other. Once you have a lot of listeners, you're being requested in a lot of places. Mm-hmm. So then I started doing speaking first for free, and then I found out you could get paid for it. So the very next time someone said, yo, you want to speak? I said, instead of just saying yes, I said, what's your budget? You know,
that's an important question.
What's your budget?
That's an important question.
These days I don't ask for the budget. I just say my price. But those days I was like, what's your budget? And she was like $1,000. I was like, cool, I'll take it. So like I got paid a G, and then I tried to go for a G again, but you don't always get it. So then I got $200, $400, $350, $500, $750, $1,000, two G's, back to one. Yeah. You know, just like the reps, the motions, like, okay, cool. And you know, when you're first doing something, whether it's VC, whether it's media, whether it's real estate, you want to prioritize in the beginning for reps. So I'm doing whatever it is for free to start. It doesn't matter to me. I just want to get the reps in. Mm. And I started getting better and better. And so speaking started picking up. I got signed by an agent. To anyone listening, yes, there is a profession that exists where it's like a salesperson whose sole job is to sell you, and you don't pay them anything. They just make a commission. The catch is they only take people on that they feel like they can sell. Right. Mm. And so I found an agent who was like, yo, you know, you got a lot of stuff going for you. Let me represent
you. They found you or you found them?
I had a literary agent. Someone's like, yo, you know, you should do a book deal. And then I asked her if she knew any speaking agents, okay. Introduced me. And the first time I signed to an agent, my rate for speaking got up to like $3,500. Mm-hmm. I was like, all right, bet. You know, it was higher than my $1,000 I was charging, but they take 20%. 20% of $3,500 is like $700. So I was netting like $2,800. All right, cool, I could do. And it was just whatever they brought me. So it was really net. So anyway, so here I have this podcast is being listened to by people, is feeding my speaking business. And every time I went and spoke, I noticed people weren't recording their shit. I'm like, dude, you're leaving out the main value. Record it so you can turn it into small business content, so you can feed it to social, so you can get requested in more places. And it just all feeds each other. So that's what I was really doing. I had the chance to do another podcast for the Washington Post, similar sized deal. And so just over time, it's all feeding each other. I'm speaking a lot. I'm capturing it. A lot of cats don't want to capture their shit because they don't want to pay for a video guy to travel with them. Mm-hmm. I'll take a haircut all day. Yeah, I'll pay my video guy whatever I got to pay him, and the flight and the lodge. These days, my agent knows that I always travel with video, so now that shit gets covered for me, and I just pay my guy for the craft. But so as you can see, as you grow in the game, you get efficiencies dialed in. Mm-hmm. But when you start, you gotta come out of pocket. So I'm eating into my own profits, sometimes not making any money, sometimes costing me money to pay for the video guy, but the video and capturing is essential to the craft because that is what allows that particular engagement to live beyond that engagement. And there are some companies throwing massive conferences with no one capturing anything.
If it's not recorded, it didn't happen.
It didn't happen. Yeah. And so anyway, so I'm capturing these talks, communicating it. I'm one of the only kind of younger cats like doing it this way. And so then that picks up. And what next thing you know, man, the phone turned into a vlog, turned into the podcast. Turned into someone hitting me up and saying, hey, you want to do a TV show? So, and and then it happened.
So the TV show, Mark Samuelson.
Marcus Samuelson, yep.
Yeah, Top Chef. Harlem Ties too.
Yep.
Did you know him or did you meet him? And I guess Alicia Keys is also the executive producer of it as well, right?
Yes, she is.
Did you know them prior, have a relationship, or met them during the process?
So Mark, shout out to Marcus Samuelson, man. Good brother. One of my original mentors, an Italian guy, he told me, he's like, yo, and this is, you know, I don't know if you guys heard me say, like, you got to be top five in whatever you do. You got to come up top of mind. If not, then you're missing out. You're leaving opportunities on the table. That mentor taught me that. And he told me, he's like, you got to be top five in Harlem if you're going to build in Harlem. And right now, number one in Harlem is Marcus Samuelson. So you got to go and build with him. Crazy to think years later he's executive producing my show. Now we're making money together. But at that point in time, I was like, fuck, all right, I gotta get to Marcus. And I was emailing him, stuff like that. And eventually
pull up to the restaurant.
Eventually he invited me by. We had coffee. He liked me a lot. And I interviewed him, similar to this. You know, I like using interviews as a way to build relationships with people. Yeah. For sure. Yeah. Now you guys know all the players. And then I had someone approach me about doing the show. And the cool thing about packaging a show is that there's junior talent and there's senior talent. You usually will have the junior talent kind of be on camera, which is what I was in this production. And then you find bigger names and attach them to the product, to the project. In this case, it was Marcus Samuelson. Marcus, who signed to WME, that's Alicia's same agency. Mm. We lobbed it up there. We're like, yo, she might be interested. She was interested.
Wow.
Came on to the project. And now it's four of us. Marcus, Alicia, me, and then Beth, the original creator of the show. And, you know, then we had two legs to stand on. And what you do is you develop what's called a sizzle reel, which is like a two-minute preview of the show. Where people go wrong in TV is they spend way too much money on the pilot. They'll drop like 10, 15, 20 G's. I don't care how much money you spend on the pilot. Your pilot's going to be fucking terrible your first go around because you don't even know what you're making. And so my producer, the EP of the show, she actually was like, she's a very seasoned TV executive. She made Pimp My Ride. Mm-hmm. And she told me, she's like, John, that show bought me my first house.
Yeah, so she's, ride was the shit back then.
So, yeah, I mean, she made a real hit show. Yeah. And so as a result, she knew, hey, let's not spend any money on the sizzle reel. Let's actually just rip existing footage, splice it together. What we did was she camped out outside of Alicia's trailer one day after outside of an event, and she got Alicia's voiceover on the sizzle. So that gave us enough credibility. And with that two-minute sizzle, with Alicia's VO on it, voiceover, we were able to go to market. And like one thing about selling a TV show is not enough to know the companies. You got to know the specific buyers within that companies, because there's buying departments whose sole job is to look for things to put on their cable roster, on their lineup. Mm-hmm. And so we went, BET was interested, Netflix, we had some interest, Oxygen, we had some interest, but Vice emerged as very interested. They called us in. Like, it was very clear from the beginning that they were very, very interested. And what they did was, what happens with a series is they bought the pilot. So they actually funded, instead of us shooting our own pilot, this is why I said, hold off, use a sizzle reel, use that as a selling mechanism. Then a network will buy the pilot. They'll fund the pilot. So now your pilot is coming from the specifications of the network, and they're telling you how they want to see it. And the cool thing about this deal is after you shoot the pilot, they have 4 months to pick it up. If they pick it up, great. You got picked up. You're going to season one. If they don't pick it up, you get the show back, and then you get to sell it
to another network
with a pilot that was made on someone else's dime. Mm. No one knows that shit. Like, I mean, experienced TV execs know that, but I was blessed because Beth gave me the insight. And I told her, I was like, hey, look, I'm going to be, I guess, on camera talent, but like, you know, I'm a fucking businessman, and you know, like, I want to do this only if you'll lift the curtains and give me a real honest look at like what this whole process is: budgeting, developing the concept, creative, producing, you know. And, you know, she was like, all right, let's do it. If we're fortunate to get on a ride, because 0.01% of all pilots get picked up. Mm-hmm. And we defied the odds. We got picked up, and it was a crazy ride, bro. It was a 22-person crew. I mean, it's a multi-million dollar budget show. Yeah.
How does that work? So, like, when you get picked up after the pilot, is it per episode, or are you getting paid for the season?
So full disclosure, I, you know, was just on-camera talent for season one, because you got to start somewhere. So the way that the mechanics work, because I got insight, is a production company gets paid a per episode fee. That production company will say, hey, it's gonna cost us 300 grand, 400 grand, 200 grand, 100 grand, whatever it is to make the show, you quote it out. The network agrees. And then the production company typically keeps like 10% of the budget is their fee. And then they get to make whatever this, you know, whatever money they don't spend. So like if it's $100,000 per episode, but they made it for 70, they keep 30 plus their fee. So anyway, that's how the actual mechanics work. But just like you're going to find a common theme here, you're not really going to make a lot of money in your first real estate deal. You're not really going to make a lot of money in your first angel deal or your first speaking gig or season one. You use season one as a way to get it going. Now Beth, who sold the show to Vice, can now turn around to another network and sell another concept a lot easier. Mm-hmm. And then we can get picked up season two and so forth.
Romeo Brown said that. Yeah, if you remember, we had an actor when we was in LA. And
Episode 17.
He said that. He said exactly what you said. He's an actor. He's not a producer of a show. But he was saying that even for like an actor, your first year or 2 years is like nothing. Then now you can negotiate it's like a like it's like sports. Yep. Like your first contract is a little bit of money, and now you're in a position. Okay, I performed. You know my work ethic. You see this. Now you the second deal is like
where it's just like your resume.
And interesting thing is, I went to the negotiating table with delusions of grandeur. I was like, "Yo, I want 20 G's an episode," because I had heard that that's what you get paid.
Take it or leave it.
And they were like, "Yo, remove a couple zeros," you know. Like, and so like, but I was like, "Yo, how can that be?" Because I had a reference where I was making more per episode on the podcasting, and I realized actually that is the case. Net TV has so much leverage because they know that once you're on air, you're gonna make a lot of money, and so you actually get paid very little to be on unscripted, i.e. reality television, because they know that you're gonna make money on the exposure.
Like Love and Hip Hop.
Yeah, like most of the characters. Yeah. Well, people, they're not even characters. They are characters. We know a few.
Yeah.
We know some of them, yeah.
Shout out to Love and Hip Hop.
So that's how it works. So anyone looking to make, you know, again, TV.
Well, let me ask you this before we end this. All right. You're an entrepreneur, right? The way this is going, does it make sense for somebody to go that traditional route or to go an independent route, YouTube, and like what's your thoughts on that?
I think right now, it's a great question. I think right now, October 25th, 2019, that the current climate right now, there's a lot of money to be made in branded projects. Branded projects, that is a brand like Modelo, Corona, Nike, Adidas, Cadillac, whatever. Cadillac. Like all these brands are looking for ways to reach consumers. Remember, we started this media segment by me giving the basic truth, and that was for a reason. Messenger, message, audience. It could be on the phone, it could be on the vlog, podcast, writing, TV, doesn't matter. But the reality is that these days, brands are looking for new and elevated ways to reach audiences. And the way they're doing that is via smaller content creators like us. Mm. And if you could position yourself the right way, you can position yourself to extract some of those dollars because those budgets are flowing around. I'm fortunate to see them. They're flowing around. Brands are spending $250,000 for one event, one night. $250,000 for an event. You know, $500,000 on a podcast, literally a podcast season. Few million on a show. You know, these brands have budgets. Now, here's the thing. I don't know how much longer this is going to last. I'm looking around like, yo, what the fuck? Like, there's money in everything these days. Yo, the other day I got product from a company called Poo-Pourri, which is like you spray this spray in a toilet before you take shit. And when I got paid to take a shit, I was like, yo, there is literally nothing that you can't get paid for. So
with the Poo-Pourri,
right? So with that in mind, I'm like, all right, one thing I know is that there's a lot of budget flowing around for creators. Another thing I know is that nothing lasts forever. So the third thing I know is I'm gonna try and make as much of this bread while it's around.
Get to the bag.
This is a market reality that's specific to our generation. There are companies spending, you know, incredible amounts of bread to create content, to build communities, to reach people. So with that being said, are you gonna put in the effort to build the community? And if you do and you become top five, you will get hit up for opportunities to get paid to do what you love.
It's a lot.
John, man, that was powerful, man. Thank you. Thank you for coming, man. We appreciate that. Something that we've really been looking forward to. And I think every segment I learned. Yeah, I learned something every single segment.
You know, as you're talking, I'm just thinking like, yo, this guy's 26 years old. Those experiences that you had sound like a lifetime, sound like a biopic. Like, and, you know, I'm thinking like he's doing that at 22, 23, 20, like what?
More.
We were trying to figure out, yo, are we going to Caribbean?
Shout out to Toronto, man.
My gosh. This is like,
thank you, man. Prodigy, man. Thank you,
for sure.
Wow, keep up the great work. Not bro. Worthy of that, but thank you, man. You know, just a kid that started doing early. The earlier you start doing, you know, the more time you get under your belt. But thank you guys, man. It was great to hop on this platform. Wow, and I hope that you guys' audience fucks with it. And if they do, we can do a second installment soon.
Yeah, for sure, yeah, for sure. Anything you want to tell the people? Or make them
aware
of,
man, just like I love you guys, man, for real, even if we haven't met. Because, damn, man, like, proximity is everything, man. You can't be what you can't see. And I appreciate each of us playing our part, whether it's consuming the content and then taking action on that content, or whether it's distributing the content or sharing the message, whatever the your role in this whole thing is. I really do think we're living in some special times, bro. Like, we're living in the same way Dizzy and Bird knew each other when they were playing jazz, and the same way Nas and Hove like knew each other coming up. Like, I really think entrepreneurship or whatever is the new zeitgeist. And I'm just, you know, honored to be part of this whole space.
For sure. We're honored to have you. Troy, any housekeeping items?
Yeah. We just want to give a big shout out to everybody on Patreon.com. That is our Proud to Pay program. You already know how that works. There's five tiers. And it allows the podcast to do a lot of things, travel, put on events. Like we said, we got something coming for DC. And we got some new members. Yeah. Curvins, shout out to you, Al, Swin, Andrew, Jeff, and shout out to Rex. He's a tier five member. So shout out to him. And everybody supporting the merch on earnyourleisure.com.
Patreon is the community.
That's a big one. We said that we're going to do something when we get to 100. We have like 96 right now. So we're going to do something when we get to 100 patrons. Shout out to y'all.
And book tip of the week is Steve Jobs' autobiography. I actually read that book. It was actually a really good book. Inspirational, and it kind of outlines his whole journey in business.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, once again, thank you guys for rocking with us. We'll see you next week. Peace.
Peace.
Peace, earners.